and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I'm here today with Bruegel senior fellow Bertin Martens and Werner Stang from the European Commission, who is a cabinet member of Executive Vice President Margrethe Vestager. We are going to speak to you about the EU's new Artificial Intelligence Act and this growing industry and the growing efforts to regulate this industry. Werner, could you start us off by telling us what the AI Act does and what are the big changes that will happen as a result of it?
Simple question, difficult answer. The AI Act is not an easy piece of law because it is the very first one of its kind. You know, if you produce law and you do something on territory that is well known, or you revise existing laws and adapt it to change, that's pretty easy. We had to start from scratch 4 years ago. We just felt that we need to regulate AI, but we didn't quite know how. Why did we need to regulate AI? Because it's very important. It's not because we felt that, oh my God, AI is so dangerous, we need to do something about it. Probably we would have thought so after ChatGPT was released, yeah? But not 4 years ago. But we felt we need to regulate AI for it to be used. And that is the principle that underpins it until today. We want to create with the law, and that's what we do, we think, the framework conditions so that trustworthy AI can be developed, can be deployed, can be used, will be trusted out there, that we create a legal certainty around it so that anybody developing AI, anybody trying to use AI knows this is sort of the rules of the game. If we pull that off, we can offer that to 450 million consumers in Europe because it's a regulation for the whole of Europe. So in a nutshell, what the AI Act does is it mitigates the risks, the most severe risks that can be associated with AI for AI to be lawfully and deployed in Europe in a trustworthy way.
Bertin, what are the most significant parts of this act? We know that it specifically looks at large language models, these very big systems like GPT-4 that can be used for almost anything. I guess they call them general purpose models now. How does that look under the new regulation, and what are some of the other significant provisions?
This general purpose AI models are really very flexible. They can be compared to plasticine for kids. It can be molded in very different forms and shapes and used for many different purposes. So it's very hard to regulate all these different applications. And so that's why the AI Act, I think, has this very general provision of basically do no harm to human beings in whatever way. However, the AI Act also contains lots of provisions for the European Commission at a later stage to provide implementing guidelines, provide more details and very specific steps in how to look at this and how to assess this. And so I think the AI Act as it stands now is just the start of a longer regulatory process that will have to look at all these different aspects. Now, another important issue I think with these general purpose models is that we increasingly see that they are built into business ecosystems where these models can call in existing software and collaborate with this, or these models can be used by other companies in very different settings, very complementary business settings emerging out of that. And so the AI Act, in my view, focuses very much on regulating self-standing models, but I think in future we'll more and more have to look at complex ecosystems of models and how they interact with each other and how that's going to work out.
What about the international situation? We know that a lot of the industry leaders, like Meta, the parent company of Facebook, like OpenAI, like Alphabet and Google, they are based in the US. They are not considered European companies, even though they do a lot of business here. How does Europe set itself up as the world's first regulator, given all of the other major jurisdictions involved?
Again, probably you have to take us back to the beginning of this process when we did not discuss general purpose AI and not the large language models and stuff that you just talked about, which also means that we didn't talk about OpenAI, we didn't talk about Google necessarily or anybody else. We talked about AI as a technology. And as you rightly suggested, we focused it on specific use cases. It was not the complexity that we had in mind of different ways in which AI may be integrated into our systems, but rather very specific situations in which AI may be used in a way that is harmful to our health or safety or fundamental rights. So we had taken this sort of proportionate approach. We focus on high risks, and those were very clearly defined situations. Will I get a job? Will I get a loan? Will I be subject to predictive policing by law enforcement? So this was not a geopolitical discussion of Europe versus US or China or anything else. It was just we wanted to be sure that technology deployed and used in Europe does not violate our very basic rights to life, to health, to fundamental rights and so on. So in that sense, also all the stakeholder meetings at the time were much less with the digital champions of that we're talking about today, but with the normal guys in that industry, right? So it only became a much more global issue once everybody started to look into ChatGPT and its consequences. And this is when we then started work at the G7 to work towards a code of conduct and at the G7. When the Americans came up with their voluntary agreement and the president signed his executive order in October last year or September, while we had the Bletchley-Park Declaration in the UK. This is when all this international interest and excitement started to come in. But that was not the beginning of the process.
The US and the EU have taken, in some ways, complementary approaches. Both have been concerned with consumer protection, for example. But some of the early stuff coming out of the White House seems very entrepreneurial in its focus. I've seen initiatives on job creation. I've seen concerns about technology transfer, about working with overseas customers. The EU, in contrast, has focused more on overarching regulation in a way that critics say cuts back on entrepreneurship. And this has been a criticism from the outside of other big EU tech regulation. I'm sure you're familiar with that argument. So I was wondering if you could put it in context for us, specifically regarding AI, but maybe also generally.
I'm indeed familiar with the argument, and I don't really agree with it. You will not be surprised to hear that. I don't think that our approach was so fundamentally different from how you described the US approach, because when we came in, when we started 4 years ago to lay out what it takes to make Europe fit for the digital age, this was not predominantly a legislative agenda. It was a two-pronged approach, if you want, where we said, first and foremost, we must invest in these technologies, in digital technologies, because that's the future of our competitiveness, of societally benign innovations in the areas of climate change or healthcare and so on. So we need Europe to become a stronger player in the digital sphere. But at the same time, we said this digital transformation must be done in the most trustworthy and human-centered way possible so that our rights and our values and our laws are respected whenever we engage in the platform economy or whenever we use artificial intelligence and so on. So it was always those two things together, and they are not even contradictory in our opinion, because once you have this platform regulation in place or AI regulation in place, you create legal certainty. Some companies will always say, oh my God, that was disproportionate and that's too much and it's cumbersome. But the worst thing that I'm being told by many companies, the worst thing for them is lack of legal certainty. If you have to take major investment decisions, business model decisions, research and development decisions and so on, you need to know what you're up to. If you have a rule book in front of you and you know, okay, well, that's if I want to use or deploy that type of artificial intelligence, that's what I have to do, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can adapt to this. But when you do so, you have this legal certainty and you have a huge market because it's a regulation in EU jargon, meaning it applies directly all over Europe. So you have 450 million customers at your disposal. So regulation does not necessarily mean that this is the opposite to innovation. On the contrary, if it's well done and proportionate, I think it can be a great engine actually for economic activity.
How much work do you have ahead of you to provide that certainty? One of the comments from industry groups has been that there are so many areas of uncertainty in the bill that was passed. I recall seeing one industry PowerPoint that had something like 90 areas where it wanted to see more definitions and more clarity as it tries to work in this space.
That's a fair argument, and I would consider it a weakness and the strength of the law at the same time. We had the same already on platform regulation, looking into the Digital Services Act. Because what would have been the alternative? The alternative would have been to come with very prescriptive, clear, detailed obligations, but they would have been outdated by the day the regulation enters into application. Because it's a fast-moving environment. So the other alternative would be, oh my God, we don't legislate at all because it's a fast-moving target, so we just lean back. But that was not an option because the risks are real, and also the risks to legal certainty are real, but also the risk to our citizens. So you had to act, but we didn't want to be overly prescriptive. So we opted for a more flexible approach. It's really dynamic regulation, and that's also its weakness as much as its strength, that it's more principles-based, that it is open to change as well. Because if new risks are emerging and if new risk mitigation tools and methods are emerging, we don't need to revise the law for there to be legal obligations to identify and mitigate risks. Yeah, it of course means that we don't know exactly what today's legal obligations will mean in 2 years from now. So if there's totally new risks, totally new business models, technologies, there will be obligations arising from today's law. So it's a challenge also for the regulator. There's a lot of regulatory innovation in this as well.
Bertin, you've written a piece for Bruegel expressing some skepticism that the time is right to get this involved in the regulation. And I'm wondering if you can fill us in on that, particularly given all of the uncertainties that we just talked about.
First of all, I think I agree with Werner on what he just said, that the AI Act as it stands now is a sort of a balance between creating some sort of legal certainty, at least, or a framework for legal certainty, and then creating also the platform on which the regulatory platform on which you can build to, as the technology evolves, to add further guidance and regulatory measures and steps to that. So I think in that sense, it's a good balance. The question, of course, is to what extent does that balance really match the way in which the industry is evolving at the moment? Every day we see new types of applications, new types of business models coming up, new international competition context. China also has its AI regulation, for example, but that's clearly much more focused on investment in AI, on promoting the use of AI in society and by its companies. The US, as you said, is a much more leaning back approach because it has all the big companies in that domain on its own ground. So I think the future will be the judge on how this is going to turn out.
When we come back, we'll talk about more what's in the act itself. Let's talk about some of the details of what's in the AI Act. One of the things that is hotly debated is how to regulate so-called open source artificial intelligence projects. These are ones where the code is available for people to work with it. On the one hand, it can promote an ecosystem of developers working on similar projects because they have access to the same base materials. On the other hand, people can put whatever they want on top of this and, I suppose, build things that might be dangerous. So should open source be regulated differently? And given that it seems to have different transparency obligations under this act, how should we go about thinking about it? Renner?
First, I would like to place this into perspective in the overall AI Act, because that has only come up as an issue when we addressed the general purpose AI, world, whereas most of the AI Act today, as it was conceived at the beginning, focuses on use cases, high-risk use cases of AI, where this was never an issue. So the question here was now, if there is powerful general-purpose AI systems, which can be used for so many different purposes, is there a difference between closed systems and open-source systems? Are there grounds to exempt open source for one reason or the other or not? And the debate was very, very diverse and depended to whom you spoke. Because there were those people who said there is no difference whatsoever if there's lots of risks emerging from such models. They may be even more risky if they're open source because there's less control along the value chain. So if the model is faulty and is then developed further by others downstream, who can ever manage any risks that may emerge then? Whereas a central model can first be tested much more thoroughly at the central stage, and then its release is also much more controlled, and so there's more checks and balances in the system. Others are saying, no, that's not right, because open source means it's more transparent by definition, and you need less of a regulatory instrument that makes its workings transparent because it's in its very nature transparent. And then there were industrial policy type of arguments saying, well, not Austria, I'm Austrian. Europe is very strong in terms of open source. It's a huge open source community. So we need to be softer on open source because that's where Europe's strength lies. I think the outcome of the negotiations is really a very measured one, in that we are saying that the very largest, the most powerful open source systems are not exempted from anything. So if you are a systemically relevant system, then you have to do everything that the Act asks also of the closed systems. It's just if you're a smaller general purpose system of an open source nature, you are exempted from most of the transparency provisions for the reasons that I gave. But you are not exempted, for instance, from copyright-related obligations that also those models will have to be trained in full compliance with our copyright law. And they also have to provide this sort of summary statement of what type of content went into the system to start with. So I think it's a balanced outcome overall.
Some of the countries that were most involved in the debate leading up to this were France and Germany, because they are home to Mistral and Aleph Alpha, some of Europe's better-known AI startups. Also, these two countries are very involved in the broader EU competitiveness debate. Bertin, can you give us some framing for how to place these efforts in the EU's broader policy concern?
Yeah, Europe is, for the time being, not home to the largest models. There's large, very large models that would soon meet the threshold under the AI Act of systemic risk models. But so we have smaller companies and startups here. And for them, the way out to grow and to become a relevant player at a global scale is, first of all, to find a way of collaborating with big tech companies that can offer and have access to huge cloud computing infrastructure, which is what you need to train large models. We have cloud computing providers here in Europe, but they haven't proven yet that they are up to the task of training these very large models. The second reason, I think, why European smaller startups need to find some way of collaborating with these bigger tech companies is that companies like Microsoft have established business models, and they offer many type of consumer and business services that are profitable and are working business models. And if you can plug your inner AI model into these services, you have a guaranteed source of revenue. A self-standing smaller AI startup that does not have access to these business outlets will have a very hard time to become a viable business. So I think these collaborations are a good way forward for smaller European companies. They stop short of a merger, but the question is, well, how deep does that collaboration go? And so several competition authorities have started to investigate these links, and we'll see what comes out of that. And also these links are evolving very fast over time. But I think for European companies, this is a good way to go forward.
We're recording this podcast shortly after Mistral and Microsoft announced a plan to work together and for Microsoft to take a stake in the French company. Fiona, you've seen in the press this week some commentary on French lobbying and corporate lobbying and vested interests getting involved in the AI Act. Can you give us a commission perspective on what's useful and what's not useful in the debate?
I don't think I can give you a commission perspective on what is useful and not useful. I also don't, of course, I don't know what is behind all of those allegations as well. So who knew what, when, and took what decisions on that basis, that I simply don't know. It's just, of course, a bit strange in retrospect, remembering the 36 hours of negotiations in the last trilogues, mm-hmm. early December, when the arguments were we should be softer on startups, not overregulate the GPI space, precisely to make sure that European startups have a fair chance in the game. And then to find out if 2 months later that one of those names that was mentioned repeatedly actually is not just a European startup anymore, but teams up with a very large American company, which in its own right, there's nothing wrong about it. And indeed, there may be lots of synergy gains or necessities in terms of access to cloud or computing power, whatever it takes. But it is a bit odd, a personal opinion, in retrospect.
With names in the news, it's interesting to me that Microsoft, which is the big American company we're talking about, also has occupied an interesting middle ground for the Digital Markets Act, which is the EU's flagship technology regulation also coming into effect. Microsoft recently didn't get designated a gatekeeper for its Bing search engine and its ad service, and I believe also its Edge browser. So is there room for a big giant that isn't at the very top of the pile of giants to be considered a challenger in this EU framework to open up the walled gardens of the biggest tech folks?
Well, it's an interesting question, even beyond the DMA designation process. And of course, now we have the 7th of March coming up is also the D-Day for compliance, and there will be we will, of course, also provide all the information on the outcome of our discussions, negotiations, decisions in this space. But overall, of course, we are seeing now a situation where big tech companies are involved in the game from many different perspectives. So we're no longer talking about sort of the first wave of digital business models in the beginning of the century, where some garage-based software engineers may have had a great idea and were able to scale up a lot of uncharted territory. Great idea, let's do this, let's try. We now, of course, in a different world where we have digital champions that have obtained the status that they have, which means they have the market power that they have, but they also have all the infrastructure that they need. They have all the computing power, they have the cloud capabilities, they have all the digital skills in their company, all the experts, so they can, there's so many things they can leverage in all directions, and also of course combine their own force with the force of some small startups that may bring in some stuff that they don't have themselves. So we're in a very different competitive situation now than we were 10 years ago and certainly 20 years ago. So I think indeed from a competition perspective, competition law perspective, from a free market perspective, I think we will see very interesting developments in the years to come.
Breton, how do you see the AI Act fitting in with the rest of the EU's very ambitious tech regulation agenda?
Yeah, as Werner was just saying, we have this question of how the competitive landscape around AI will develop. The Digital Markets Act does not cover AI systems for the time being, but it covers a number of core platform services that may be steered and may use AI models in that respect. So we'll see how that evolves. I think it's too early to express any opinion or judgment on how that competitive landscape will evolve, because besides these very big models, in AI, we also have many smaller models and hundreds of smaller models that are being developed and that already exist nowadays. And in many applications, they can compete with these big guys. And so there is space, I think, for a very competitive landscape to emerge that does not necessarily trigger competition policy concerns. So I'm reasonably optimistic for the time being that these things go reasonably well. My only concern is, indeed, as Werner also pointed out, is that these big companies have the cloud computing infrastructure that you need to train those models. But I also see that even in Europe, cloud computing service providers are rapidly investing and building in this. And so I guess that over the next couple of years, they will be in a position to offer sufficient infrastructure to have separate development of large-scale models outside this existing big tech infrastructure.
Do you see any inherent conflicts between or among the different regulations? Because all of them are in their early stages of implementation. Certainly when it comes to managing data, there seem to be different requirements in different pieces of regulation.
Yeah, we are moving here to a slightly different area, which is data regulation.
It's true, but we use a lot of data in AI, so I wanted to ask about it.
Yes, so the other part of the AI Act, I think, which I'm personally very focused on and very interested in, is this copyright provisions in the AI Act. The AI Act says that model developers who use data taken from the internet or elsewhere and data that is copyright protected should respect copyright law, which in terms of the European Copyright Directive means that under Article 4 of that directive, these data can be used for training the model, provided that the copyright holder did not opt out of this. And if the copyright holder opted out, you cannot use those data for training your model, unless you come to a licensing agreement with the rights holder on this. I look at this from different perspectives. First of all, I think if all the data used for training of AI models would really fall under licensing, this would narrow the space of data that's going to be used for model training. And I don't think that would be a good idea, because models may become biased because they use only part of the available data. Also, for smaller companies, it will be virtually impossible to strike deals with all of the right holders for all of the data that they harvest on the internet. So necessarily, it would be narrowed down to a small part of all those data sets. And that's unfortunate. Also, another reason to look at this is that there are other countries in the world, and I'm looking at the US, for example, or even Japan. Japan has an interesting copyright law provision that says that if the material is not used for the original enjoyment purposes for which it was designed, meaning music is designed for listening music, films are designed to watch movies, but if film and music data are used to train an AI model, that's a totally different purpose. So it falls outside copyright protection and you can use it. Similarly, in the US, you have transformative use of copyright protected material. If you use it for a transformative different purpose, you fall outside this copyright protection. Now, of course, in the US, there are many ongoing court cases on this and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. And so there's legal uncertainty still about this, and that's holding back lots of AI developers, I think, for the time being, and we should solve that uncertainty. In the EU, I think it could be solved by adding further implementation guidelines or maybe even modifying the copyright directive in that respect to make it clear that these data can be used for training AI models without having to go through elaborate copyright procedures. That is, if you stay outside of the paywall. Clearly, if you're going to use newspaper articles that are protected by a paywall and you use these articles for training your AI model, there should be a copyright licensing arrangement with the rights holder.
I would probably want to broaden this from the copyright angle to the broader data strategy and data use angle, because your original question was also to what extent all these different initiatives are linked up and so on. And I think they are from the outset. If you remember, 4 years ago, we came with the digital strategy of this commission, which was really a strategy to start with. It was not just a summary or a long list of things we wanted to do anyway, but there was a strategy and a plan behind and objectives to be pursued. And at the same time, we published the data strategy and we published the AI white paper. And as you suggested in your question, of course, the link was obvious. AI needs data, but we also need data and AI for many purposes that go well beyond the training of large language models and all the things we're discussing today, because we really had sort of very industrial data in mind predominantly. Doesn't mean that it's not important what you just said, but we also had very different types of data in mind for the green transition, industrial data, and all sorts of data of a non-personal nature and not necessarily protected data, but just data that are being collected by sensors all over the place. Or health data, which is totally not copyright related, and yet one of the biggest drivers for research and innovation in the years to come, where we are creating a European health data space, so to make health-related data available in a legal form. And then we want to have the technological capabilities to actually extract value from this data. And this is why we work on data spaces and on data infrastructures and cloud facilities, and why we want AI in Europe, and why we need the computing power that is necessary for that, why we need the microprocessors that are needed for that. So, which is part of this European or the Digital Decade policy program, where we are sort of saying, well, there's a whole range of digital infrastructures and technologies that we need to come together for value in data to be extracted for many, many purposes. So in that sense, this probably the last year has a bit distracted the attention from this industrial policy-related purposes. And we're not just looking, just in inverted commas, it's important, but we're just looking into ChatGPT.
When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening next. Bertha, did you want to say some more about data? This is a huge topic, and I'm learning so much listening to you. What else should we be thinking about?
Yeah, I cannot resist going further into that question. As you know, I've been working on this for the last couple of years. Looking at this European data regulation landscape, I see many pieces of data regulation have come up over the last couple of years, all promoting access to data, sharing of data, making it easier to do so. But I see great differences between these different pieces. For me, one of the most liberal and open-minded pieces of data regulation in Europe is the European Health Data Space proposal, which basically makes one of the most sensitive sets of data, our personal health data, widely available for research. And I think that's a good thing to do. And the COVID period, for example, showed that making these data available to researchers and public health experts is enormously beneficial for society. And that's the way we should go. On the other hand, I see in the Data Act, which is supposed to be the sort of horizontal, general purpose data regulation in the EU, I see many restrictions on access to data, many anti-competitive restrictions where it boils down almost to the fact that the data holder becomes almost the owner, the property rights holder on data. And I think that goes a bit too far. Data are co-generated by several parties, at least two parties, and they each have equal access rights. And the Data Act distorts that a little bit towards the data holder, I'm afraid. And so in that respect, there's still more work to be done. There's also what Werner suggested, the data spaces that were announced in the 2020 communication on data policy, and on which still a lot of work needs to be done. And that's probably worked for the next commission, for the next college, Tudor Gron. And we need to see how that's going to develop. I see countries like China working very hard at data spaces for industrial purposes. And so Europe has to step up, step on the accelerator there, I think.
What's coming up next?
On AI, on data, on anything?
We're interested in all of it. We have about 5 minutes left in the podcast. What would you want our reader, or excuse me, what would you want our listeners to walk away thinking about?
Well, I could speak for 5 hours rather than 5 minutes, but still, I think first thing, just to build on what was just said, there is a lot of things still to be done in terms of taking it forward. You know, we have set the ground rules sometimes. We have started to create certain infrastructures or opportunities, or even just planted the ideas of opportunities. So all of that, of course, needs to be fully implemented to bring real results. If you take this example of the European health data space, which I like very much, that's a good example, because the idea really is to provide access to health data in a trustworthy and privacy-enhancing way, so protecting the legitimate rights of us patients while still making available all the potential to researchers and innovators. And for that, we need to create the legal framework first to be sure it's shared in a legal way. And we need to create the institutions on top of it, because the idea is a bit of a sort of a one-stop shop, if you want, that you are a researcher, a company. You say, well, I would want this type of health-related data. So you turn to this one-stop shop and say, please clear the rights for me, clear the data for me. So as today, it's still just an idea. If it's properly implemented, it will become real on the ground. It will, and this applies to many of the things that we have done. So it's not about creating new laws and this and that, the other, but we have to make sure that on the one hand, the laws that we have created, like platform regulation, like the AI Act, are properly implemented, complied with, enforced, up, kept up to date, while at the same time, all the practical industrial policy type of work is actually implemented in a way that real companies, real researchers are able to exploit the potential that is in them. So I think we're in for a big implementation wave in the digital space.
Are there any AI Act deadlines you'd like to highlight, or milestones, or coming moments?
Well, the legal milestones are, of course, set out in the AI Act itself with its staggered entry into force. So there's not much to be done in this regard. But I think here, for once, I will now focus on the general purpose part of it, because this is the one, this is the newest one and also the most challenging one also for the Commission, because we are supposed, we have just set up the AI office within the Commission. And since this piece of the law is very general in its nature and requires a lot of adaptation, implementation, discussion, that is the big thing to do in the next 1 to 3 years, is to fully engage with the community out there, with the companies, with the researchers, with civil society, with anybody else who has an interest, and to better understand what risks we are really facing and how those risks can really be mitigated. So while we've just adopted the law, the real nitty-gritty, but it's a huge nitty-gritty actually, is still coming up.
It's such a big task. When I think about where artificial intelligence will be in 3 years, I honestly can't even imagine what we'll be working with then. Bertin, as we close out this great discussion, what would you like listeners to walk away with?
I think the most important takeaway, at least for me, is everything is still open. We are at the start of a road on AI and also on AI regulation. This technology is evolving very fast, and we'll have to see how that goes and how we respond to that from a public regulation point of view.
Thank you both for joining us on this episode of The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow at Bruegel and Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. I've been joined today by Bertin Martens, a senior fellow here at Bruegel, who's in charge of our digital research program. And we are very honored to have Werner Steng from the European Commission and Margaret Vestager's cabinet. You can find the archive of this episode, all of our related research reports and other events on our website, bruegel.org. You can find this podcast on all of your favorite podcast delivery channels, and we hope to see you next time. Thanks.